Okay, everyone. I think we're going to get started here. So if I can have everyone's attention first. First, a couple of ground rules. You have to pretend like you're in court, because we have an AV set up here where if you talk, we may not be able to hear the judges. And any of us lawyers here, that's not a good thing. So pretend you're in court.
When Carl says pretend you're in court, he doesn't mean throw things at those of us who are here.
Yeah, so, and the second thing is I'm also, if everyone does fine here today and we don't have anything objectionable at the end, we're going to put this up on ESI Bytes, open to anyone to download and listen to, you know, freely distribute it. That all depends on if we're happy with the content. It's the same rules of all programs we do. So, with that in mind, I want to quickly share something personal here. I entered into this field from the staffing background, running large reviews. And when I sold my company to special counsel, I went on the national e-discovery circuit, and I began talking about running reviews and things like that. And I always found I was in the 4 o'clock time slot on a Friday with half the people with luggage and the other half the people had disappeared. So to be sitting here today in front of, you know, this packed room, this is going to be my new screensaver. Personally, I'm really happy to see all the people here, and I'm going to put this, and yep, you can wave. A lot of you are my friends. Hey, put the fingers down. Come on. But anyway, thank you for indulging me with that. So now, my name's Carl Shinneman. I'm president and founder of ReviewLess. It's a predictive coding consulting firm. And I'd also like to welcome everyone here live at the Carmel Valley eDiscovery Retreat and potentially those who are listening to this program on ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on eDiscovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free on the internet when you're interested in listening to it. I hope you find this session really interesting. When we put this together in November last year, we were didn't know there were going to be any cases out there. Some of us might have known, but most of us didn't.
So
that was the biggest fear. And we had a bookend panel of predictive coding users that's going to be appearing at 4 o'clock, and this was the vision. And then something happened in February, a case came out in a couple, and I thought, oh my God, we planned something in advance and something like this happens. But for those of us who work in the field, we know the issues have just grown. All of us that have ever been through a meet and confer process trying to negotiate predictive coding protocols and seed sets, there's so many more issues than there were back in November when we dreamed this, that all is not lost. I think it's even a better panel. So with that in mind, we've put together a panel of five of the judges who are very out there talking about e-discovery issues from across the country. We have Judge Nora Barry Fisher from the Western District of Pennsylvania, who joined the court in 2007, to my right. We have Judge Andrew Peck from the United States District Court in the Southern District of New York, who was appointed to the court in 1995, sitting all the way to my right. And then in Denver at another conference, talking to us over the speakerphone, we have Magistrate Judge John Facciola from the United States District Court from the District of Columbia, who joined the court in 1997. Magistrate Judge David Waxy from the United States District Court in Kansas City, Kansas, who joined the court in 1999. And Magistrate Judge Frank Moss from the United States District Court in the Southern District of New York, who was appointed to the court in 1999. So starting off here, first question is about the reasonableness of technology-assisted review based on everyday life experiences and our encountering of technology, these types of technologies in life. So, for example, Judge Waxy, do you have a spam filter on your computer, and do they generally work well?
Carl, we have a nice federal court spam filter that doesn't seem to work very well. I'm now getting 20, average 20 spam a day from some Jordanian web source that our spam filter can't stop.
Okay.
But have you gotten your money from the Nigerian minister's brother? That's the question.
We'll leave it to later to discuss whether this has any impact on computer-assisted review.
Okay. Judge Facciola, have you searched online and seen items for sale pop up mysteriously in your browser, which seems somehow related to the things you're doing online?
Unquestionably. Past Christmas, my gifted granddaughter is interested in cinema and photography, and I got her a good Canon camera. my sister called me and said, I'm looking for gifts for the kids. You got any ideas? And I said, well, I just got Anna a video camera. Maybe you want to get her a bag, you know, a cute bag that a teenage kid would like. And my sister said, I've had some luck with this website. Let me send you it. She sent me the website. I, in turn, sent it to my wife, saying, this may give us some ideas for a stocking stuffer for Anna. The next morning, as I usually do, I opened the New York Times, and there was an ad from that website.
Great. Judge Fisher, if you were made comfortable that the algorithms inherent in spam filters or online advertisements are similar to the predictive coding algorithms, would you find that helps you to understand and appreciate the potential effectiveness of these tools, that they're scalable, and that they might be reasonable substitutes for keywords to use to search for potentially responsive documents?
Well, Carl, you and I have had these discussions about how we can convince our colleagues that, you know, this might be an effective tool in e-discovery, and we've talked and debated about Daubert challenges versus motions and the attorney advocates putting before us the information that we need so that we can understand these new tools that are emerging. And as I mentioned yesterday in my opening speech, there are a number of folks on the bench who don't have the wherewithal, all of you in this audience and Judge Peck and others who are with us this afternoon by way of speakerphone have in terms of knowledge. So if you can translate and make these algorithms understandable to the federal district judge or state judge or the arbitrator who's going to ultimately rule on the reasonableness first of your discovery request and your response, it would obviously advance the argument and perhaps make the argument a winning one for you and your team.
Judge Moss, on the flip side, are you comfortable that lawyers can devise keyword searches to find most ESI in a case?
I'm not at all comfortable that they can, because usually the requesting side is working somewhat blind. The requests, at least in my district, usually have two components. First, give me any and all documents concerning Carl Scheinemann, and then there'll be a keyword request for Carl within two of Scheinemann. But if you if the database is yours and you go by the name King of eDiscovery, it's not going to pick up those documents. So I'm not at all confident that keyword searching is going to get many or a sufficient number of relevant documents.
It's a bad example. Carl Scheinemann pulls up everything with me if my name was Smith or something like that. Although the misspellings, you're never getting my last name right. So Judge Facciola and Judge Peck, this is to both of you. Would you care to discuss some of your experiences from some of your cases which have dealt with the challenge of keyword searching?
I'll let Andy go first if he wishes.
Sure, why not? My experience is the same as Frank's, which is that the lawyers are choosing keywords in the dark, what a commentator whose name I won't mention calls the go fish approach to keywords, which is the party that doesn't know the data, the requesting party, throws out some keywords blindly, and it's like the kids' game, you know, you got any kings? If so, give it to me, and if not, go fish. And that's sort of the way it works. And to take it back to a specific case, in the William A. Gross construction case, for those who really care, 256 FRD 134, take notes, come on. I was fortunate to be able to stand on Facciola's shoulders there, but it was a construction dispute. And the dormitory authority of the state of New York was one of the parties, since they issued the bonds, even though the building was a courthouse in the Bronx, not a dormitory. And the other was all the construction companies, literally all the construction companies involved in putting up the building. And the issue was the emails and related ESI by Hill Construction, who was the second construction manager for the Dormitory Authority. So the Dormitory Authority proposed terms that included the names of all the parties, Caldwell, Turner, all the construction companies. And in what was obviously sheer brilliance, they suggested also searching for the phrase Dormitory Authority and the single word authority. Think about that one for a minute, folks. Then the other side said, no, you know, not every email is going to use company names. So why don't we search for driveway, elevator, paving, you know, et cetera, which would be great if Hill did not do that work in every single one of their cases. So that issue was thrown in front of me. And having the judge choose between the two extremes is not the best way to resolve search in any means. And that's why, in that opinion, I issued my so-called wake-up call to the bar, saying that if you are going to do keywords, you got to test them. You got to talk to the people involved to find out, you know, what words they used, what acronyms, and all of that. And I liberally stole, I mean, quoted from Facciola's decision, so I'll turn it over to Facci.
I had a very similar experience in the two cases to which Andy just referred, Equity Analytics and O'Keefe. O'Keefe was a criminal case. The lawyers on both sides of the case were absolutely brilliant advocates, whom I've known for many years. The government's theory of the case was that this jeweler based in Canada had to get his sales people back and across the border quickly to make sales in the Detroit and other areas. And to do that and to expedite the processing of visas, he bribed an official at the Canadian embassy. And the original suggested keywords were, believe it or not, visa, Canada, and border. So I suggested to these two lawyers, both of whom are good friends, that they might want to go back to the drawing board, and that led me to write the opinion I did and to urge that there had to be a better way. There certainly could not be a worse way. And can I add another thought here? The three of us just left this morning a superb presentation by O.V. Carroll at the Department of Justice, who is head of the Cybercrime Laboratory and is therefore primarily responsible for fashioning the searches that the Department of Justice does of computers that they seize. It was interesting how Ovi, one of the world's great experts in this area, was entirely dismissive of keyword searching and showed us instead all the other methodologies he uses from the Windows registry and other places to do the searches. So I was firmly convinced that the forensics are moving in an entirely different direction.
So my second line of questions, and I'm done walking around the room. Cliff Dutton, you know, Jeff Buckles. Greg Buckles, I don't know how you do it. I mean, I thought I was going to trip
Carl,
half the time.
Carl, you're breaking up badly. We can't hear you.
Okay. So my second line of questions deal with what we get with the status quo. And Judge Fisher, do you have confidence that having lots of reviewers sifting through batches of documents is an efficient way to tackle a larger case?
Well, as Carl indicated in our introductions, I'm the Sally come lately to the bench. So I'm not that far removed from being outside counsel and having been involved in mass litigation and having been involved in litigation reviews going back 30 years, some of which were hard copy and some over the years became more and more electronic in nature. I do appreciate the fact that there can be fallacies in that system, just as has been pointed out by a number of the speakers here at this conference. And those fallacies are not only in terms of the individual decision mechanics of the persons doing the reviews, but in addition, you have those common everyday problems, you know, of turnover and the like. And all the can have an impact on your results. So I don't believe that that is necessarily the most efficient, and I don't believe it's the most effective way, just from my own personal experience before going on the bench, of doing reviews.
So I'm going to skip a question because I think you answered part of this already, Judge Facciola. So I want to weave in some examples of Darwinism and changes in the review process over time. Judge Waxy, Do you remember when you started practicing law? Okay. Was it common practice for partners or senior lawyers to review most of the paper documents related to a case? And do you think the first time an associate was asked to review the documents, there were concerns expressed?
Clearly, that was the situation when I first started. I mean, I am so old that I can remember being involved in putting a brief together, which meant everybody in the firm got a stack of whatever page you had, and you walked around the conference table putting the page on the pile, so because we didn't have a collator. Luckily, with a copier, did one page at a time. So, yes, long ago, things were done very poorly.
And Judge Moss, do you remember when paralegals were first used? Do you recall objections based on quality being raised to this approach?
Well, I'm thrilled to say I don't remember when paralegals were first used. It was before my time. In terms of document review, yes, and it mostly in the early days was occurring in bigger cases where neither side was objecting to the other side using paralegals because they both were for cost reasons. But in the cases I handled, some of which had documents that ranged into the millions, I was always very, very, very uncomfortable making representations about what was there or not there, or even trying the case without wading into the documents myself.
And Judge Peck, if you don't know the answer to this question, I'll answer it for you because it was a big part of my early professional e-discovery career when I had to convince lawyers that contract attorneys could do a review traditionally being done by law firm associates. So how about when contract attorneys were used? Were there similar quality issues raised that you're aware of?
Yes. Although it has happened since I've left practicing law for the bench, but the whole issue of supervision as you go from, as many firms did, hiring contract attorneys internally, which is what my firm did at the time I was leaving, to hiring outside firms to supply them, to possibly going abroad and outsourcing out of the country. All of that leads to issues of quality control and the appropriate level of supervision by the law firm attorneys of the outsiders doing the review.
So, Judge Fischer, to wrap up these questions, do you think the common strand here behind these changing approaches, we won't talk about offshoring, but these changing approaches to manual review, which have become much more accepted over time, have had anything to do with attempts to increase both the efficiency and lower the price of document review work?
Certainly, I think that they were utilized to lower the price. And from my own experience, more and more I saw as I ended up my legal career, the need for budgeting up front. Insurance companies and corporations were always looking at that. They wanted a cost certain. So if you could reduce the overall cost of the review by using lower priced individuals, that would certainly be a factor. I don't know that any of these systems increase the efficiency. Maybe somebody in the audience or on the panel would disagree with me on that front. I don't know. But they were intended, I think, to reduce cost.
So, Judge Peck, can't we say the same thing about technology-assisted review, that efficiency is one of the driving forces behind this movement, as well as quality?
Efficiency, quality, and cost savings, because if it's done right, it means that the need for eyes on review of documents is significantly reduced. You know, it does not reduce the need, or at least most lawyers feel the need, to do the eyes on review of that group of documents that after going through the computer assisted review are being produced to the other side. But the vast bulk, which could well be 50, 60, 70 or more percent of the documents that are determined to be not relevant or so unlikely to be relevant as not need anything other than a quality review, quality check, all of those do not have to be reviewed, and that is a significant cost saving, as well as the whole issue of, you know, is eyes on review the so-called gold standard, to which the obvious answer, as was talked about by Craig this morning and others, is absolutely not.
And I'm going to continue with this on this question, Judge Pack, because you've, as we all know, have examined this space in perhaps more detail than most judges in the country. And what academic examples did you find to be the most persuasive that these tools also may work better than manual review? I mean, was it TREC results, your experiences watching the output of human review with large amounts of ESI, or demonstrations from technology vendors?
I guess the answer is all of the above, but specifically, even if eyes on review were the gold standard, it's just absolutely cost prohibitive and ineffective nowadays. And in addition, as the various studies, all of which, a lot of which the authors are in the room and sitting to my left and will be talking, or one of the pair will be talking at 4 o'clock, and that is Maura Grossman and Professor Gordon Cormack. Their studies, their articles in the Richmond Jolt Journal of Law and Technology that were cited by Craig Ball this morning, the TREC results, that is the text retrieval project of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, clearly show, and I have quoted them in the case that may not be named publicly, so you can get the exact sites there. All of those studies show that technology-assisted review is infinitely better at recall and precision when done with an appropriate process than keywords, even good keyword searching, and or manual review. In addition, and Herb Reutblad is here somewhere, the material hiding in the back, thank you, Herb, for raising your hand, the material that he and Ann Kershaw and Patrick Oot did for the eDiscovery Institute, another paper that shows that computer-assisted review outdoes keywords or any other review method. So there's lots of literature out there. Carl came and did a demonstration a few years ago for some of the judges of the Southern District of New York to actually show a little bit of how the technology and the concept clustering and things like that worked. And frankly, one of the reasons I come to these conferences, besides imparting whatever words of wisdom you think you're getting from me, is that I learn from all of you. So this conference, prior conferences, legal tech, all of that, there's a lot of material out there that I've relied upon.
Now, we're going to leave the defense, this issue of whether these judges like these or believe in these types of tools. We're going to enter the brave new world of emerging issues now. And so for this section, we're just going to accept that courts and parties are going to increasingly be exposed to the use of these tools. And if we accept this premise, we have lots of other issues we can talk about. So, I'm going to encourage the individual judges, if they want to jump in and supplement answers, because there might be disagreement and things like that, feel free. So, Judge Waxy, let's start at the beginning of the process. A common question I get from companies is whether disclosure to the other side is required. I mean, why can't statistics be enough? Sample what you left behind and what you found, and I mean, what comfort did we have with paper and box reviews that we were getting what we were entitled to? And the producing parties would often rather just turn over what they have to without someone looking over their shoulder the way we used to handle discovery. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what we have to put this in the context of is the huge amount of volume. And as John Fatiola said, we heard a presentation this morning that had more up-to-date figures on volume. And with the kind of, what was he calling, zettabytes. Covering the entire globe with 3 feet of paper or something. That kind of volume, it doesn't matter whether we're comfortable with paper reviews. I mean, that kind of approach. We've got to deal with it in another fashion. And I think, I don't want to get on my soapbox too quickly, but the key to getting to just, speedy, and inexpensive is cooperation, which it really impacts this e-discovery question, because my perspective is we do not need an adversarial approach to every discovery issue. There ought to be the ability to sit down and work out what is the best way to find the information that's needed in this case. And the starting point for that discussion has to be a discussion of what are the actual disputed issues in the case. I keep running into cases where lawyers have started doing e-discovery on volumes of information, and I'll say, well, what issue does this relate to? Well, we don't know what issue. It's an employment case, so we know we're going to do all the employment stuff. And if the only issue in the case is much narrower than that, you're wasting a lot of time and money. So cooperation has to start with that level of getting the issues defined and see which ones you actually may not have a dispute about. And the next step then, once you figure out what the issues are, get a joint plan on how to find that information.
I'm going to jump in and follow up on that for a minute. I think there is absolute unanimity from all the judges on this panel that cooperation is the right way to go, despite yesterday's panel's unwork product that I at least heard. And I'll pass on to my colleagues when I get back to them. But in specifically, do you need to disclose that you're going to use computer-assisted review to the other side? Is there something in the federal rules that says you gotta tell them that? Probably not, you know, query whether it's required under the 26F discussion. But in practical terms, the last thing you want to do, unless you know you've got an adversary who you've dealt with and is never going to raise any issues because they're just happy to get any discovery, however, you know, it is, the fact of the matter is it's likely to come up, and in my opinion, it is better to get it resolved upfront, good, bad, whatever is going to happen. But if you are going to go that route, reveal it to the other side, go to the judge if necessary. But, you know, you don't want to spend the money to do a full predictive coding run and then have the other side find out about it late in the day, go back to the judge, and be told, as one of the lawyers here was telling me, you know, that they were in front of a judge who said, I don't care that it's a million emails. You have to do eyes on review of everyone, and because it's late in the day, you got to do it fast. That's, you know, that's not the result that you would get from the judges on this panel, but better to know, you know, the good, the bad, or the ugly up front than at the end of the day, in my view.
Yeah, I want to ask you, Judge Fatsciola, because we did a podcast a while back on...
Yeah, I was just going to say that Andy and I walked around Legal Tech and saw booth after booth, I guess it was last January or February, each of which essentially was communicating, buy our black box and we will solve your problems. And that may be true, but I guess the experts in the field are of the view that different tools yield different results. That suggests that you're not going to get 100% accuracy, and some tools may be better for some problems than others. And I think it's really suicide not to reveal, A, that you're using predictive coding, and B, what tool you're using, tool or tools.
So let's talk about when you can't agree. And we did this podcast in the past, Judge Fatsciola, Judge Grimm, myself, and a couple of others, Maura Grossman and Chris Dale, who are here. You know, this happens from time to time. In fact, I wish I could do horse noises, Craig, but, you know, I'm involved in that Virginia case where the horse left the race somehow. But, you know, when you can't reach agreement with the other side, what's your suggestion on bringing it to the court? I mean, you know, is that still relevant?
This is, I take it that's for me. Well, the easy answer, of course, is bring it to the court. But the point is, you can't reasonably expect the judge to stop everything just because the two of you cannot agree. What I think the judge is going to be interested is in the nature of discussions and how, what you have discussed and where is the precise dispute between you. In other words, what I'm saying is calling Chambers and saying, Judge, we can't agree, doesn't tell me anything about what I ought to know. So this might be a very important point, for example, to jointly create, submit to the judge a five-page memorandum which explains what the situation is. Now, it's an important thing, and I think, again, this came up today in the discussion we're having, listening to Paul Grimm talk about Rule 502. The fact that a particular topic is not specified as one of the topics which must be discussed under the federal rules on the 26F and 16 doesn't mean that a judge is not going to insist that you discuss it. So even though it is not one of the specified topics, I would be shocked and I use the word advisedly, if the lawyers did not bother to tell me that they'd been at each other's throats for a week and couldn't resolve this most fundamental question, I'd be extremely disappointed when they showed up later on and were throwing motions on it that they didn't give me an earlier opportunity to help them if I could.
So let's talk about using the output to validate results. And following up on Judge Peck's excellent article, Search Forward, Judge Moss, can sampling help to validate the proposed solution of using advanced analytics? For example, can an initial sample, such as setting a baseline of the level of responsiveness in the data set that's likely responsive, provide us with a measure of what percentage of documents in the collection might be needed to be produced with some allowance for privileged documents?
Well, I think sampling obviously needs to be done to verify the quality and accuracy of the process. But when you get to how it should be done and details like that, I think judges are uniquely unqualified to answer the question. It seems to me that if you're, it would be difficult, I think, in the current environment for people to say, well, 95% accuracy is good enough and we'll stipulate to that at the get-go. I would think that sampling to determine the accuracy of the process in a particular case, as opposed to sampling to determine the efficacy of a particular tool, is something that would come a little further down the road. In particular, once you've been through a few iterations and in a rolling production, the other side has started to see the quantity of documents they're getting and the sort of documents they're getting. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but that's my thought.
So let's talk about perfection as a standard. We've talked a little bit about that over the course of the conference. Judge Fisher, is perfection ever the real goal? I mean, don't we know that responsive documents are going to fall through the cracks, and it happens all the time, for example, when companies are acquired and you lose track of where the ESI is?
Well, in my view, and I think the case law and the rules support it, perfection is not the standard. The standard is reasonableness, and you have to also consider proportionality, and then you further have to consider good faith behavior. And all through this, I think that attorneys need to take strong heed to the requirement of meet and confer. Not email each other, but meet and confer to discuss the issues. And so with that, no, I don't think perfection's ever the standard. I don't think anything in this world is perfect, and that includes litigation, and certainly includes e-discovery.
So let's jump into a critical issue. If there are actually challenges to the tool, and we may get some disagreement on this question. Is a Daubert hearing required to validate the use of these technologies to find relevant ESI, or can this be accomplished more informally through sampling and discussions with technology experts? Because we never required such high standard of validation with keyword searching and whether the keywords were actually working. So, Judge Facciola, I know you have views on this, and Judge Peck, I know you have views on this, and again, it's okay to disagree.
Fatch is wrong, so I'll let him go first.
Well, Peck, with typical New York style, is picking a food fight that doesn't exist. I know the bloggers looking for something to do love to see our views as antithetical. They're nothing of the sort. We were dealing with very different situations. As I've just told you, I was dealing with cases which lawyers were proposing words that we would all agree, any reasonable person would agree, would not do anything except produce amount of useless information that was hopeless. In that particular instance, I wanted to bring home to them that in their arrogance, they should appreciate how sophisticated the area was, and that they should get used to relying on people who knew more than they did before they articulated their position to the court. I didn't mean to say anything more or less. Andy did exactly that, and I know he can't talk about his opinion, but I can. Andy did that most masterfully in his recent opinion, where he sifted through what the experts had said and explained to anyone who would listen to him why he was reaching the conclusion he did. There's absolutely no antithesis between what he did and what I said in my case.
Wow, I'm speechless. And let me go a drop further with thanks to Fatch. In my Search Forward article, which I am allowed to talk about, I opined, in an article that the reason a Daubert analysis was not necessary is because Daubert was the gatekeeping process for admitting evidence at trial. And what we are doing here is discovery. And yes, the court needs to be informed by the appropriate sources, whether that's the lawyers providing the information or whether it is the vendors, consultants, experts also providing the information. But it is not a formal Daubert issue. It is this a reasonable way in this particular case to get in a proportional way, as Judge Fisher mentioned, to get the information. It is not, we are not getting the results of that 3 million or 1 million or whatever emails and offering them in bulk into evidence. If that were the process, then Daubert might well apply. But it's not. When out of the, 1 million emails sorted through, some percentage of that were produced, and then we get to trial and 10 to 15 of them will be admitted in or offered into evidence, then the question is, as to any particular email, is it authentic, is it relevant, is it hearsay, all of the traditional tests, as with any other document or any other piece of evidence, not how did you go about finding it from the producing party. So I don't think that Daubert applies in this area at all, but, it is important, as one of my colleagues said, not all judges understand this or know this, and, don't take any chances. Make sure if you are pitching this to the court that you give the court the appropriate information so that the judge can make the decision. Whether it's 5 minutes for Tom Ricks or 55 minutes, as he was telling me privately before arguing in Virginia court, whatever it is, marshal your evidence appropriately for the judge, but not for Daubert purposes.
I just want to say how disappointed I am. I wanted to see a fight. I promise you at 4 o'clock we'll have some fireworks when Maura Grossman and Tom Gricks talk about Nullsats. So
you want to see a fight? The Yankees, not the Nationals, are going to win the World Series. Fatch, your turn.
Why is that drawing any laughter? Carl, back on subject, can I add something?
Go ahead.
I think the starting point here ought to maybe be the law. And the law is set out in the Federal Rules of Evidence. And if you look at Rule 1101 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, it says these rules apply to all proceedings in United States District Court, civil cases, including whatever, and it says these rules do not apply to the following. And it's a list of exceptions. There is no exception for discovery under the Federal Rules of Evidence. And the Federal Rules of Evidence, as you know, in 702 says you do not allow an expert to testify unless they meet certain standards, sometimes referred to as the Daubert standards. But it's right there in the rules. There's no exception for discovery. And there's a good policy reason for that. In fact, Paul Graham was speaking this morning at our conference, and in his very clear terms, he said the reason we have to follow these rules is because you want to have reliable information. And the way you know you're getting reliable information is you go through the Rule 702 steps and make sure that witness can meet those standards before you let them testify. So I don't think you can bypass this by saying, well, this isn't evidence, this is just discovery. If it's information presented to a court, it's covered by the rules.
So we'll continue with you, Judge Waxy, into one of these technical issues you hear about sometimes in the field is some of the tools score documents, rank them based on their score, with the higher rank score documents maybe being the more responsive. Should those be presumptively produced despite a follow-up human review, especially if we believe the technological results are less prone to inconsistency?
You know, I think that's real dangerous unless you've got an agreement on what you're doing. I mean, that may be a perfect solution if you've agreed on the tool and you've agreed on what you're using the tool for. But I'm not sure that just on your own you ought to say, well, and don't even tell the other side. You just start doing something based on scores that the other side doesn't even know what the scores are or how they arrived at or what they mean. It seems to me, and I don't want to be too redundant here, but you start by trying to get an agreement on your process and then an agreement on what your standards are. And certainly if you can get an agreement, I don't think any judge is going to care what your agreement is. And if you can't, I can't answer this kind of question as a judge in terms of sort of the words without any meaning to me. I mean, it seems to me it's depending on your tool you use and how their scores are set up, so I guess I don't have an answer for your specific question.
Okay, and Judge Moss, you'll have a chance at the similar question with a lower scoring document. Should they be presumptively not produce because the cost of reviewing the, quote, crap, in the hopes that a few responsive documents pop out? And if you feel the same way, that's fine. We got plenty of questions.
Well, I guess the first answer to the question is the same as what Dave said, namely that if there's a stipulation, that's fine. If you've agreed that below a certain score, you're not going to review documents, there's no issue. But absent such a stipulation, I think not to sample the so-called crap and determine whether there are responsive documents, and there's a very dangerous road to pursue. I heard in recent months of at least one instance where somebody took the position that they simply weren't going to review because the case wasn't worth it. Documents that scored at a certain level of unresponsiveness. And it seems to me that's a decision to be reached either by stipulation or perhaps by the judge in the case, but certainly not by one party unilaterally concluding that that was not required.
Well, I think, you know, it has to be done transparently or translucently, says a certain person sitting in front of me who will talk at 4 o'clock and explain the difference. But I think, you know, the overriding rule is still 26B2C proportionality. And you can't review every document. I mean, if you're going to wind up eyes on review of every document, you probably don't need computer-assisted review except maybe for workflow purposes. I think you can't pick a cutoff blindly and say, once I've spent X, I'm stopping. I suspect with these systems that rate the documents, when you take a look at it, you'll see that all of a sudden, at a certain level, you know, relevance is going down slowly, and then perhaps there is a sudden drop. And that may well be the point that you use as your cutoff, but you must quality control and sample what you're not going to review in full. And I think it then depends on what you find. You know, if you find one or two smoking guns in that material, there is something wrong, and you're going to have to go further. If you find no relevant documents, or what's more likely, you're going to find some documents where the relevance is so marginal and repetitive of what has been produced, then you probably don't need to go further. You also might discover, sorry guys, I'll let you get a word in a second. You might find that there are particular types of documents that, because they're expense reports, and I'll use Maura's story of a case, and this is public, she has used it before, where in looking at the so-called rejects, there was a particular expense report in a price-fixing case or something like that, and it showed a meeting with a competitor, and therefore she realized there was a need to take a look at all expense reports that otherwise looked to the coding system like would not be relevant. So quality assurance, quality testing, clear review of every single document, no.
But Andy, in the old days, when we weren't talking about electronic documents and it was the proverbial warehouse full of documents, one side would not unilaterally decide, I'm going to look at the boxes that relate to custodians 1 through 5, but this case just isn't worth it in terms of dollar value. I'm not going to bother with custodians 6 through 10, who may have relevant documents in there, but come on, you can't expect me to do that. There'd either be a discussion with the other side, or there'd be a discussion with the judge, or somebody would be on very thin ice. I think, as David has said any number of times, the same sort of rules apply whether you're talking about paper or electronic files. And I don't think a party should be unilaterally concluding where the cutoff point is in many cases.
I don't disagree, but the difference, I think, in that example is that there was no review. If you trust this technology, the fact that these documents are getting a very low relevance score is similar to, you know, do you have to look in the paper days at every piece of paper in the client's office because somebody might have misfiled something? Or if you're looking for documents about the XYZ contract lawsuit, can you talk to the client, and when they say, you know, everything we have is in this file in the central office, files marked XYZ, and then I've got my personal XYZ file, and stop at that point? And we'll turn it back to Carl.
Sure. I'm going to skip to a new area. This is one I heard fairly recently earlier in the year about lawyer ignorance is a barrier to adopting predictive coding, and it's one of the more common defenses I now hear for keeping the status quo approach of review to cite its flaws, that lawyers need time to learn how to use these tools and to work together. And frankly, it's catching up to the defensibility concerns we used to hear back in 2010 when we were holding these training sessions to try to figure out, you know, is it okay to tell people, can we tell people that, you know, about defensibility, what judges, you know, think about even talking about these tools. I remember statistics cited at Georgetown a few years ago illustrating the number of cases where electronic discovery was not used as examples of opting out from e-discovery by lawyers in most civil litigation matters. So since it's an ethics question, I Judge Fascio, I want to give this one to you. Do we raise the opt-out bar further when we're adding technology and statistics into conducting document review?
Well, we certainly do. I mean, I could understand why a lawyer who has a case whose potential value is X is shuddering at the notion that the cost of only doing this is Y, and Y is greater than X. So we do have to trust lawyers, at least initially, to make the judgment as to how much money is worth it to do this case. And I think it's the height of arrogance for judges to say that there is only one way to do it, and it is this way, using the very top of the chain, the food chain, in terms of the technology. This case may not need that. So it requires a lawyer's judgment. By the same token, that lawyer has to realize how the earth is moving under us. Under the APA 2020 program, one of the proposed amendments to Rule 1, which I think is more likely than not to be incorporated, is the obligation of a lawyer as part of his competence to be aware of the benefits and dangers of technology. Well, the benefits of technology would, of course, be to reduce the cost for his client of what may be the most significant cost of the case, the cost of searching electronic data. A lawyer who is not familiar with this runs the risk, it seems to me, of the client a disgruntled client saying that he failed in his most fundamental responsibility to ascertain whether there was a cheaper way to do this, to make the client aware of that, and permit the client to make a reasoned decision. So the lawyer's competence is shifting as we speak. By the same token, I am troubled by any notion that every case has some quantum of electronic discovery that must be done. The failure to do it is unethical. I think that's an impossible standard for lawyers to meet. So it's a fine line here, but obviously a situation where the lawyer presents only his own ignorance is a situation that is not going to be very attractive, either to the judge or ultimately, when things go wrong, to bar counsel who looks at his behavior or her behavior.
I've got a bunch more questions here, but I know we've got a big audience. And if anyone has a question, you can raise your hand, and I'm not going to hit all my questions anyway. So I'd encourage you to raise your hand. I'll ask a question, and then I'll come over to whoever raises their hand first that I see. Pricing of the software is an objection to doing more work. I've heard from some litigants that they encounter objections to using more predictive coding because the tools cost too much. For example, some companies offer lower-priced hosting and raise the price at the moment in time the analytics are used. Other companies offer lower prices than others, but are not as well known. Judge Peck, is it fair for an adverse party to challenge the pricing of the particular tool as creating unfair barriers to accessing documents when there are other alternative tools perhaps in the marketplace?
I'm not sure in that question who's objecting on which. If it is the responding party, it seems to me that they need to figure out what is cost-effective and either hire the appropriate vendor based on the need to use predictive coding or similar technology or not. I think that it would be very hard for me if the requesting party were to say, I think you should use the XYZ vendor opposing party because I know that they're the lowest price bidder, etc., and that way you can do predictive coding. I think to a certain extent the vendor used, the approach used, should be left to a certain extent in the hands of the producing party, but balanced against the cost of the software, the technology, the vendor, should, of course, be the cost saving in not having to review nearly as many documents for a much better result. That'll all have to be balanced out. So far, I have seen nothing in any of the cases in front of me about pricing models or anything else, so I may have a different and maybe better answer when I've got more information about it. That's the best I could do for you now.
Carl, let me add something, because I think pricing alone is a ridiculous criteria to use, because that would only assume that you've got comparable systems that are going to do comparable work. If there's a difference in what they're going to do, you certainly can't look at pricing alone. You've got to do a comparison of the end result, which is obviously the quality of the work and the price.
I apologize for drafting that question.
I have a quick question that came up in an earlier session, and that has to do with whether or not some of the vendors will be required to expose how their technology works, how the algorithms are generated, thereby potentially disclosing their trade secrets. Will that ever come to be? Or if you have any thoughts on whether that should be done?
And since, Judge Fisher, you had the next question, maybe you want to weigh in on that one.
Well, I think that the case could be made in front of a judge that if this is your true proprietary trade secret information, that then in that event there should be a protective order. It would also seem to me that, as you dialogue with opposing counsel, that you might be able to talk about generalities without exposing the full algorithm, i.e., what is it that it is set up to do rather than exactly how it works. I don't see that I would be in a position ever to order that be produced. I just don't see that would be the way I would go on something like that, because I generally have a tendency to respect, you know, that trade secret or proprietary information, whether it's in this arena of e-discovery or in other arenas with which I deal on a day-to-day basis. You know, other judges may have other views. I mean, there may be an extreme case where you need to dig that deep or drill that deep, but I don't think you'd have to.
I would certainly hope not to have to look at that.
I'd like to address this question to Judge Peck. Because
yeah,
Judge Peck,
I would certainly hope not to look at it. But if you get in a situation where you have two conflicting positions by parties on which kind of system to use, and you as the judge have to make a decision since they can't get an agreement on it, I don't know how you could fully understand what is the best decision if you didn't understand how it works and therefore what's the likelihood from your perspective of it being the best one to use. So, you know, I haven't had to deal with it yet, but my thought is if you have somebody come in and say, well, mine's best, but I'm not going to tell you how it's going to be used, you're either going to tell me or we're not going to be choosing you.
My thought is, generally speaking, I don't care how it works. I care that it works.
Right.
And I think that producing parties have to be given a certain degree of deference. It's not unlike when one party says, we want a neutral person in charge of the process at the producing party to harvest all the documents before they look for the relevant documents, and the producing party saying, well, we're going to particular custodians and asking them to give us everything that they have that's responsive. The first way may be more expensive and may be more accurate. I generally defer to parties who want to do it the second way, but caution them, if it doesn't work, they may be doing it over.
And I'll note, for whatever it's worth, that there are about 600 pages of transcript from Magistrate Judge Nolan's hearings in Clean Products dealing with the use of predictive coding on the one hand versus keywords on the other. And nowhere in all of that is there any revelation about the black box, so-called, of the computer-assisted review. So it is certainly possible to have lengthy hearings in that issue without going there.
Right.
So I have a question, and I guess I would direct it mostly to Judge Peck, because you have expressed, you know, a support of the idea that one might eliminate documents from Eyes on Review based on the results of scoring from predictive coding. And it's come to my attention, I think a lot of people's attention, that some of the larger corporations who have been using predictive coding are continuing, because they don't believe in the defensibility of the technology, are continuing to review those documents at the lower end, at the very low end of the threshold. And I'm just wondering, at what point do we finally say, okay, it works, you don't have to duplicate your efforts?
Probably at the same time we get companies to stop over-preserving because they're worried about spoliation sanctions. You know, for those of you who are either in-house counsel or outside counsel to regular clients, that's why you get paid the big bucks, and we don't on this panel. Make those decisions. But look, if a party wants to spend its money as sort of insurance, certainly knowing that the technology has said these documents are not likely to be relevant, I would suspect that the reviewer speed and therefore cost of review can be brought down greatly. But I don't see why you should, and frankly, what's the worst that could happen if you don't? The other side complains, and the judge says, you need to review every document. Then you'll go and do it. So I would say, stop doing it, get the courage to do that.
Here's a softball question for you. So I learned
I'm worried already, Gavin.
It's not even technical, I promise. So I learned everything about what you guys say from listening to Tom O'Connor. He's my translator from legal speak to normal people. We went from Oklahoma, so we have the Eastern District of Oklahoma, where our judges don't get to attend these types of events, and our attorneys don't even know they exist. How can our local, non-New York, non-elsewhere, learn everything that we're learning today? What resources should they read, and how could they interpret that and ingest that, both at the federal level and at the state level? What do you recommend as a starting point?
You know, the last time I looked, Kansas was right there by Oklahoma.
And I was shocked when I first met you, Dave, that you had computers in Kansas.
And I remember when I checked into a hotel and in Darko, Oklahoma, they gave you a fly swatter.
Can I jump right in and answer that question?
Before we get in any further trouble.
All right. I love the jokes, though. We in Pittsburgh face similar issues, and I know it was particularly troubling to my colleague Joy Conti that the level of experience and competence in the bar was where she did not think it should be. And to that end, that was one of the motivations for us to embark on the special master program I talked about yesterday, to help raise the bar, if you will, at least for a time. And I hope, like Craig predicted, that over time you're not going to need those types of special masters or e-neutrals because the bar's competency level will raise. But one thing that we've done very effectively in Pittsburgh, and very cheaply, I might add, through the Federal Bar Association, we do quarterly lunch and learns on e-discovery issues, and we bring in those people to the courthouse, to our jury assembly room, and I think for the princely sum of $25, they get an hour or hour 15 of CLE credit and a lunch, which is generally good, and the law clerks get to eat for free, which is also great. And that has helped us across not only our bench, but also across our bar. Those are sellouts. The other thing that we do in our community is something called Friends of eDiscovery, and it involves outside lawyers, inside lawyers, and paralegals, and some vendors. And we also get together approximately every quarter in some place or another, and whoever's hosting, whether it's the federal district court or a law firm, they buy breakfast. And again, we have real dialogue about these issues. And I know in the last 2 years that I have wholeheartedly participated in both of these ventures, I have learned a lot. And I think it's really that simple to start to inject these issues, this law, these principles into the community. And that's going to help you, you know, meet the challenges, particularly the practicing lawyers, and I would think corporate counsel to make the grade, if you will, in-house by doing those kinds of proactive things. And in my estimation, they're really not that hard to pull together.
Yeah, and I'll add, we set one of these up in Indianapolis last week with 30 people. I'm talking to people in Nashville. I'm happy to fly out and talk and help people set a Friends of eDiscovery type thing up, but then it's up to the local community to keep meeting and talking. But those have been very, very useful, and we all learn a lot in a community.
This is Facciola. I think you have to say, there has never been a time in human history where it is cheaper and more efficient to educate yourself in terms of the available information that is out there for free, such as all the Sedona Conference press principles and the entire website. Each year at Georgetown, with a program that I've done with Craig Ball and others, we test people on their arrival, so we get some measure at the end of the week of how well they've done. Every year, the level of intelligence of the in this area of the people arriving keeps increasing. So I think Judge Fisher is quite right. You can educate yourself quite easily if you try, and if you find people who, like you, want to learn more about them.
And for the one or two people in the room who may not know where it is, the Sedona Conference website is very easy. TheSedonaConference.org, and it's got wonderful material.
Okay, I see a question over there, but before I get over there, I'll ask one, which I'm going to attribute to Chris Dale behind me to some extent, because we had a little talk about the cost side. The RAND Institute survey in April put the dollar estimates behind different tasks associated with document review. The obvious allure of predictive coding, according to RAND, it has the potential to reduce the cost of review by the 75% benchmark RAND set to make review costs more palatable. However, the second most expensive item is processing, and predictive coding requires upfront processing of documents as an investment to let the software and expert reviewers kickstart the system to cull the documents without requiring the expensive review. So, Judge Peck, what do you think of the argument that processing costs can be recovered as a form of taxation of litigation costs under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 54D1 as amended, which states, unless a federal statute, these rules, or a court order provide otherwise, costs other than attorney fees should be allowed to be to the prevailing party, and then Congress under 28 U.S.C. section 1920 specifies as taxable costs fees for exemplification and the cost of making copies.
District courts out of Pennsylvania were going the furthest in giving those costs until the Third Circuit weighed in on it, and that's the Race Tires case, and they, the Third Circuit, specified that the costs that are equivalent to making copies in the old Xerox photocopying days are recoverable, but not the search costs and not most of the processing costs. There are at least two decisions out of the Northern District of California, the names of which are escaping me as I sit here, that even post-Race Tires have said, well, that's the Third Circuit, it's not the Ninth Circuit, so I'm going to give huge amounts of costs to the prevailing party. I've seen none of that happening yet in the Southern District of New York or the Second Circuit, but I suspect that Race Tires is probably going to prevail, and that you will need to work with your vendors to carefully differentiate between costs that are similar to making copies and costs that aren't, and it may well be that vendors will shift costs accordingly. In their pricing models to make it easier to recover at the end of the day. We'll see how that all works out. But since most cases settle and don't go to trial or other ways where there would be a judgment and Section 1920 would kick in, it's probably not going to be helpful in any event except in a limited number of cases.
Okay, we started late, and this is the last question. Unfortunately, I wish we could do this for longer, but there are other speakers, so here.
Thanks. Thanks, Carl. My name is Jeff Fowler. I'm an outside counsel, and so, you know, my job as an e-discovery lawyer is to be a professional meter and confer and cooperator. I do it all day long. As you were discussing the differences between manual and technology-assisted review, I was thinking about our manual review process and the fact that it has evolved over the years, and that today's manual review process involves a number of daily quality control assurances and sampling and decisions that we are making traditionally without cooperating with the other side. You know, yesterday there was a lot of talk about work product protection, but even aside from that, just practically speaking, picking up the phone every time that you run across a decision as to whether to QC another 5% of the documents, it just isn't practical. And so as we move forward and think about when to use technology-assisted review and how to convince our clients to use it, one of the stumbling blocks that I'm encountering is that clients have an option. We have 1 million documents. I can put 50 contract lawyers on it. We will be engaging in a manual review process. It's an eyes on every page, but it involves a lot of complexity that we never have to discuss. We can get it done in 4 weeks. Or I can go to the other side and speak with a lawyer who probably doesn't know anything about e-discovery and try to educate them on technology-assisted review. And if I'm not successful, apply to the court. And if I have to apply to the court, then we're going to have to go through a lengthy process of hopefully getting some agreement. And by then, I've spent 4 weeks and $1 million getting the ability to use technology-assisted review. And I fear that our desire to cooperate, it may actually have a chilling effect on our ability to use these products, because the clients will choose to go the old route in order to avoid what they perceive as more trouble or more time going towards the burden associated with disclosure. And so I make that comment wondering if you have any reaction to that or whether or not there's some balance in the level of cooperation such that we could begin to use these tools and decide you know, how to involve the other side and maybe to not involve the other side in a traditional case.
I guess all I would say is, in cases where the volume is high enough, and I'm seeing a lot of that, the cost effectiveness, even with motion practice, is probably still going to come out on the side of technology-assisted review. In addition, obviously, I know from various people here, et cetera, that more people are using it than in the three cases that are the poster children in the horse race that we heard about this morning. So it's obviously happening out there. Talk to your colleagues, get, you know, their views. It's probably better than ours because, you know, if people are getting it done either by cooperation and agreement or by doing it and taking their chances that the other side is so ignorant that they'll never raise an issue and so you could do it, something is happening that people are using this technology now. And whether it's just go ahead and use it, whether it's, you know, there'll be more cases coming down the pike, whatever it is, the problem isn't going to go away. And we've got to use whatever technology and approaches we have, or we're going to price ourselves out of the justice system.
It also, this is Frank, may move forward more rapidly in the administrative context or even in criminal investigations where you have somebody sophisticated on the other side who values speed in terms of production, understands the concepts, and is willing to have you use predictive coding so that they don't have to wait a lengthy period of time for documents.
You know, and another option that's out there that Pennsylvania is leading us on is if you can't get the cooperation from the other side on your own, get the court, or on your own, get a third-party neutral involved that has this reputation and the expertise that maybe they then can convince both parties here is a solution that's going to cost less and be more effective.
Okay, with that, I'll add that at 4 o'clock, we're actually going to have a couple of lawyers and technologists who are dealing those issues and meet and confer and getting both sides to agree to talk about those issues and other issues. So we'll, and from what I hear, we're going to have some beer, maybe some 4C wine there. So that's an added draw late in the day. You know, and the assumption we're going to post this on ESI Bytes, I'm going to end here by thanking Judge Fisher, Judge Facciola, Judge Waxy, Judge Moss, and Judge Peck for joining us here at the Carmel Valley eDiscovery Retreat. Yep. And potentially on ESI Bytes. And I'd like to thank Chris LaCour and the Carmel Valley eDiscovery Retreat for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our shows, where I encourage you to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.